Hello, and welcome back to Catching Up on Capitol Hill, a series in which we discuss the latest in tax legislation and in tax policy. I'm your host, John Gimigliano. In our last episode, we dug into one of the more interesting provisions in the House-passed tax bill, the proposed retaliatory measures of new Section 899. Now, there's a lot more to say about the House bill, but really, there's not a lot more time to say it. That's because the Senate has returned to Washington and is now poised to act on its own version of the bill. We'd love to do an episode about all the many policy choices available to the Senate, what they might or might not do. But well, such an episode could be quickly overrun by events as soon as this week. So instead, let's just set this episode up to point out where there is a high probability that the Senate bill will differ from the House bill. We should probably also discuss how these differences will ultimately have to be resolved between the House and the Senate before the bill can become law. To help me do that, we've got regulars Jennifer Gray and Tom Stout with us today. All right, so Tom, let me start with you. First question, well, let's start maybe at a high level. What are some of the big issues that we think the Senate may have to deal with that were in the House bill that may not go over quite as well in the Senate?
Well, probably the biggest one has to do with the spending cuts that the House put in. These were cuts particularly to Medicaid and food stamps that are very controversial in the Senate. And, you know, they're in there to offset the deficit cost of the TCJA extensions in the bill. And those are important to a lot of members who are concerned about increasing the deficits and increasing debt. But that's probably less a concern in the Senate, and the spending cuts in particular are more of a concern over there.
And of course, we've got 53 Republican senators. Not all of them are going to view these in the same way, I think is the point you're making, Tom, that some may say, these are great. In fact, maybe we should do more than what the House did. But others may have concerns about what the House has done, whether or not these are actual cuts to Medicaid or they're just improvements to the program. They're going to be in the eye of the beholder. So is that what you're getting at, is that some of the senators are likely to find to be problematic?
Yeah, absolutely. That's true both House and Senate. There are internal conflicts in terms of what the House and Senate want to do that are going to complicate this going forward. And as you say, the majorities are thin in both House and Senate. 7-seat majority the Republicans have in the House, 6-seat majority in the Senate, which means in both houses they can only afford to lose 3. So they have to listen to every small group's concerns about the bill.
I would agree with that. I think that there's a very strikingly similar dynamic intra-party in both the House and the Senate, where you have generally more moderate members who, as Tom, you said, are expressing discomfort with some of the changes being made, particularly the entitlement programs like Medicaid. On the other hand, in both chambers, you have fiscal hawks who are quite concerned about the level of deficit spending and feel like the only way you can address deficit spending is by looking at those entitlement programs. And so the dynamics are very similar in both. And as you said, Tom, given the 3-seat majority, it's a delicate balance for the leadership, a tightrope there for them to balance on.
Right. And as John says, there are members there that would be perfectly happy with having those spending cuts be even deeper than they are.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, let me ask you a question. You worked in the Senate from a leadership point of view. So in the House, very challenging. You pretty much had to make everybody happy at once, the moderates, the hawks, everybody, which Mike Johnson did, to credit there that he was able to keep them all together just because of the incredibly narrow margins and the size of the different groups for and against things in the House. But in the Senate, is the dynamic a little bit different? So if you're majority leader, John Thune, he's not going into this trying to get 53 yes votes, right? He's really aiming to get 50. Does that mean he can sort of tell 3, sorry, you're just going to vote no against it as long as I can get 50 and J.D. Vance to cast the tie-breaking vote? Or do you think he's really trying to get all 53 to yes?
Obviously, in an ideal world, they would love to have unanimity among their conference, but certainly the focus here is getting to 50 votes in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. So that might mean that the moderates maybe aren't going to be happy and they can vote no. Or maybe he's getting the moderates to say yes and the deficit hawks to say no. But then, of course, he's got a problem back in the House. Either way he goes, he's got a problem back in the House. So that's why it's going to be so interesting to watch play out. Jennifer, let me ask you then. So Tom talked about the spending cuts that came out of the House. What other kind of big issues do you think that the Senate is going to have to deal with that the House may or be in a different place on?
Well, I think on the tax side, obviously, there are always going to be an unlimited number of tiny issues that folks are going to have different opinions about. But I'd say the two major issues from the tax focus in the Senate are likely to be the same two that there were in the House, which is, how do you deal with the various tax incentives in the Inflation Reduction Act, focus on clean energy, alternative energies, et cetera? How do you deal with those? Again, very different points of view. To some degree, those points of view are along those more moderate slash fiscal hawk lines. And in some ways, those might be geographic, that certain areas of the country have taken advantage or seen investments from some of these various credits and tax incentives under the Inflation Reduction Act. And those representatives and senators perhaps want to keep those in place, or at least see a gradual sunsetting of those to allow some of these investments to move forward that have already begun or are scheduled to begin. So I think that's one area. The other is the SALT area. Very, very different dynamic in the Senate. There really are not senators in the Republican caucus, with the exception of maybe one, who strongly feel that that SALT cap of $10,000 needs to be increased. However, there is, of course, those members in the House. And so to some degree, this is a matter of the Republican senators being on one side, and be honest, the majority of the Republican caucus in the House being on one side, which is comfortable with the $10,000 cap and leaving that where it is. But you do have a sizable number of members in the Republican caucus in the House whose votes you need because of that tight margin in the House. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is going to be a major, major issue.
So SALT and IRA, let's break those down each separately a little bit here. So let's start with IRA. We've had a number of Republican senators say pretty publicly that they are not happy with exactly how the House did it. And there are certain things that they are going to want to modify. Can we think about the IRA completely, that they just want to provide more relief across the board of the IRA? Or do you think there are more constituent interests that they care about this credit more than that credit in the IRA? And it may be, depending on the technology or the specific credit within the IRA, some may get better or worse treatment. What do you think, Jennifer?
It's absolutely the latter. There are particular members who have interest in particular code sections and investments taking place in their states, and those are going to be their priorities on how do they continue to encourage those investments in their states through the IRA provisions.
Yeah, a lot of people are talking about the IRA as a monolith, and it's not. So that, oh, don't worry, the Senate will be gentler, a more orderly exit from the credits than the House would have proposed. And maybe, we don't know, of course, but I think you're right, Jennifer. You have to ask specifically, go credit by credit, to figure out who is going to champion what, and will all of them get the same treatment, or are they going to be different? Tom, Jennifer talked about SALT. Dig a little bit more into SALT. Like, what are the options available to the Senate then? If they don't like what the House did, what could we see in the Senate? Because Jennifer correctly pointed out, and I can't remember, one of the senators said yesterday, I think it was, zero Republicans, senators from New York, New Jersey, or California. So our view is different. What do you think the Senate might do differently?
The geographical element plays into both of these issues, both the IRA credits and the SALT limitation. You know, clearly the members, particularly on the House side, that are concerned about the state and local tax limitation are the ones in New York, New Jersey, California, in, you know, sort of marginal Republican districts that have elections they're looking at next year, where that limitation is important because the relatively high tax areas that limitation is really hitting. In the Senate, it's not the same kind of problem, where it's statewide, and Republican members currently in the Senate are representing states that tend to be less sensitive to that issue, you might say. There are more states that are more largely rural or small town, and as a result, you know, the SALT limitation doesn't hit. You're talking about the IRA credits. I mean, I was thinking of a particular example of that that really illustrates the issue. On the Senate side, you've got Tom Tillis in North Carolina, who is currently looking at a $14 billion investment in electric vehicles and batteries that he's concerned about that might go away. But that might be a concern that's particular to those areas, those credits, and maybe he doesn't care as much about the others.
Mm-hmm. So it's going to be complicated as they work through coming up with a solution. And they're well aware that whatever they pass, it's great. Their number one priority is to get something through the Senate. But of secondary importance is passing something that is dead on arrival in the House isn't a great outcome either. So thinking about how these are going to land in the House and trying to do those both at the same time. But the number one priority is, of course, to get it through the Senate. Tom, let me stick with you for a minute. Let's go back high level again. The House and the Senate are accounting for their bills in very different ways, correct? And tell us how.
The House has proceeded with the traditional way of accounting, using what's called a current law baseline, which is to basically take the law as it is and calculate the effect of the changes on that baseline. The Senate appears intent to use what they're calling a current policy baseline, which is to assume that the current policies that are in place are permanent. even if they expire. And that's particularly the case with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act individual provisions, which are all set to expire at the end of 2025. Assuming that all of those changes remain in place permanently, allows the Senate to basically read their changes out of the deficit number, which is particularly useful for purposes of what's called the Byrd rule under budget reconciliation rules, which requires that changes that take place outside of the 10-year budget window that increase the deficit are subject to a point of order. If you assume that all those changes are already in the code, then you don't have that problem.
You mentioned current policy baseline, the Byrd rule under the rules of budget reconciliation. Just to remind everybody, we did episodes on both of those earlier in the year. We didn't waste our time. Those are still live issues. But you're right. If we just think about the Senate budget, the reconciliation instruction for a moment, if we assume that extending the tax credits and giving themselves that under current policy baseline gives them basically $4 trillion of air quote free money. They also give themselves $1.5 trillion of additional deficit. So that's 5.5. Do you think it's fair to say, either Tom or Jennifer, that there's more headroom for tax cuts in the Senate than in the House and maybe less pressure on revenue raisers? Or do we think that they're going to end up with just as many revenue raisers as the House did in the end anyway?
It depends on how many tax breaks you see come into the Senate bill that perhaps you did not have in the House bill. Is there more appetite in the Senate for individual members' priorities, et cetera? And to the extent that those are tax cuts, that could potentially increase pressure to find money from other locations. And to circle back to SALT, if you look at the SALT provision that was in the House that, again, Republican senators do not prioritize, I just pulled up the number. It's about $750 billion just for that one provision. So they have to be looking at that and thinking, hey, that's money we could use for other things, or at least part of that money they could use for other things in the Senate.
Jennifer, should we expect other senators to come with requests in this bill beyond what was in the House bill?
1,000%. I mean, the senators know that this is a train that is leaving the station that more than likely is probably going to be enacted in some form in the next 1 to 6 months. And so if you're a senator, whatever your priority is, you are looking to get it on that train. And I always make the joke, every senator thinks they're a king or queen, and they are very used to being able to use that leverage in ways that sometimes maybe House members aren't as used to.
Didn't Senate Finance Chair Mike Crapo say something like he's got a whole list of requests from his members?
Over 200, and that was as of, I'd say, a couple months ago that I had heard him say that. So I would not be surprised if that list is almost doubled by now.
Yeah, so there's even more differences potentially between the House and the Senate bill, is if the Senate adds all these items that senators want, is the House going to accept them? Tom, what else around current policy baseline do you think is going to create conflict between the House and the Senate?
Yeah, to sort of bring this back to where we started, problems with the deficits and increases in the debt. The House bill, as it currently stands, would increase the deficits over the next 10 years by $2.4 trillion, according to the CBO, not including interest on the debt. In the Senate, where they're using that current policy baseline, basically what they've done is given them the $3.9 trillion that it would cost to extend the TCJA cuts, and then another $1.5 on top of that. They're talking right now about $5.4 trillion increase in deficits. That is going to be a problem back on the House side, where they were concerned just about the 2.4. So getting back to House-Senate differences, it's a significant one.
Now, in fairness, that's the net tax cut number, correct, Tom? So any spending cuts that the Senate would be able to enact would offset some of that?
Right. And it puts more pressure on them to try to find more spending cuts. But again, those become controversial, because they were already having problems with those at the current levels in the House bill.
Yeah, and I think some ways finding those spending cuts that are acceptable and can garner those 50 votes may be more difficult in the Senate than it even was in the House.
Yep.
Let me conclude with this question then. Differences between House and Senate. We're in June now. We think that the Senate probably does get a bill out of the Senate in June. But then the question is, how do these differences get resolved? The ones we've talked about, and I'm sure there are going to be others. But when the House and Senate get together to reconcile these, how's that going to go when we get to, I guess, beyond the 4th of July, if they don't resolve them sooner?
Well, whatever the procedure is, it's not going to be easy, given the differences that we're talking about. Speaker Johnson referred to his dilemma as trying to cross the Grand Canyon on a piece of dental floss. And that's a good description of the tightrope they're really walking to try to resolve all of these issues and reconcile all of the various elements of the parties in both houses in order to get this done.
To Johnson's credit, he's done it so far, but it keeps getting more and more challenging for him. So we'll see if he can do it here on this one. Jennifer, what about you? How do you think this is going to go when the House and Senate try and reconcile their two bills?
Well, we haven't mentioned President Trump here, and I think he has the potential to be a major factor. He certainly seemed to have been a major factor with the House bill. We know that he has had Senate Republicans to the White House already. He seems to have engaged quite early in this process here in the Senate once that bill came over from the House. It's going to be a challenging. There's no question about it. And again, with the margins this tight, cannot overemphasize how important that is because of the leverage that it gives each particular member, that they only need three of their buddies for a group of four, whether in the House or the Senate, to be able to really extract demands and how this bill is going to be drafted at the end of the day. Again, it's going to be a tightrope walk to get this finished.
Difficult as it is, though, I mean, I think it's important to remember that this is what Republican priority 1 through 10. So there's a lot of pressure to get this thing through.
I think the president could be quite important in this process.
He's the closer, right? You know, they're calling him out of the bullpen here in the ninth inning to close this thing. See if he can do it yet again. He successfully did it in the House bill and times before that. But this is going to be the most challenging one of all. And it's going to be one of the things we're going to be watching all summer. So Jennifer, Tom, thank you very much. In closing, maybe just a word on what all this means for timing of the bill. We obviously laid out a number of issues that the House and the Senate are going to need to reconcile before this bill can become law. And if you think that the complexity of that negotiation means that a July 4th deadline or even an August 1st deadline for enactment seems unlikely, well, I completely understand that. But I think looking back at what has happened at every step of this bill so far, the budget, the development of reconciliation instructions, the passage of the legislation in the House, well, we have to acknowledge that the one big beautiful bill, it has defied the laws of political gravity so far. Can it continue to do so? I don't know. But I do know this. I've had to recalibrate my timeline a few times already. And so I humbly say that leaves the possibility that the looming tax cliff, well, it could be averted sooner than any of us expected. The coming few weeks are going to tell us so much about the trajectory of this legislation. So we should all buckle up because pass, fail, or temporarily derail, this summer is going to be jam-packed with tax legislative action. With that, thanks for tuning in to Catching Up on Capitol Hill. Take care, and I hope to see you soon.